Our opening words are from Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons? By Ursula K.
Le Guin.
Thank you. So, what then are the uses of the imagination? See, I think we have a terrible thing here. A hardworking, upright, responsible citizen, a full-grown, educated person who's afraid of dragons and afraid of hobbits and scared to death of fairies. It's funny, but it's also terrible. Something has gone very wrong. I don't know what to do about it, but to try and give an honest answer to that person's question, even though he often asks it in an aggressive and contemptuous tone of voice. What's the good of it all, he says. Dragons and hobbits and little green men. What's the use of it? The truest answer, unfortunately, he won't even listen to. He won't hear it. The truest answer is, the use of it is to give you pleasure and delight. Yet beyond that, I arrive at my personal defense of the uses of imagination, especially in fiction, and most especially in fairy tale, legend, fantasy, science fiction, and the rest of the lunatic fringe. I believe that maturity is not an outgrowing, but a growing up. That an adult is not a dead child, but a child who survived. For fantasy is true, of course. It isn't factual, but it is true. Children know that. Adults know it too, and that is precisely why many of them are afraid of fantasy. They know that its truth challenges, even threatens, that all that is false, all that is phony, unnecessary, and trivial in the life they have let themselves be forced into living. They are afraid of dragons because they are afraid of freedom.
All right, it's time. Okay. First of all, thank you, everybody, for coming today. It's great to see so many friendly faces. Thank you for smiling. I really appreciate that. Thank you for dressing up or wearing house colors, if you did. Thank you for representing. Thank you to Jason for inviting me to give this talk. Thank you to all of my helpers today and for choosing wonderful music and helping me out with the readings. Thank you to Lawrence for helping me look over the sermon. Thank you to Sharon also for helping me look it over. Your spouse is a tough act to follow, let me tell you. So I hope that I can make good on that promise. So let's begin. In 1998, Sharon and I were living in Austin, Texas, while I was in my graduate program. At some point, I got tired of reading textbooks, and I wanted to find something different to fill my leisure time. Graduate students have a lot of leisure time, by the way. Okay. I was in a local bookshop, and a small display caught my eye. At that time, it was a small display. We've heard so often, don't judge a book by its cover. But what a cover this book had. Gold decoration, a unicorn, a boy riding a broom, reaching out to catch a ball that had wings. I went to the library shortly after, not having a lot of money. As a graduate student, the library was the first stop rather than the bookstore. And I found the book there. I think that I read Sorcerer's Stone in a day. And thus began a relationship with Harry Potter that has now lasted for 20 years and still counting. If any of you have been to Target recently, you have seen the Harry Potter 20-year celebration stuff that they have. But Harry Potter was not the beginning of my grand tour of fantasy literature, and it hasn't been its end either. Besides the Wizarding World, I have visited the realms of Oz, Middle-earth, Narnia, you can cheer when you hear your favorite if you like. Narnia, Sunnydale, Discworld, Westeros, even Prospero's Island for my Shakespeare fans. As a kid growing up in the 1980s, this was not a fashionable choice. I remember Dungeons and Dragons coming under attack from TV evangelists and from parents' councils. I recall words like nerd and geek hurled at anyone who didn't fit a schoolyard mainstream, myself and my sister and my friends certainly included. In many ways, the Stranger Things trope of the kids playing D&D in a basement away from everybody else suggests something about where we had to go to get away from the constant mocking question, what are you doing? What is that? And yet, here we are, my friends. How many of you wore something today to indicate an affinity for some fantasy story? How many of you cheered for some fantasy realm? That's right, the geeks made it. Yes. We survived. So perhaps we can start with the question of why did we hold on so much in the face of this marginalization? What is it that made and still makes these worlds so very compelling to us? To answer this question, it may be useful to begin by drawing a distinction between fantasy and science fiction, which are two closely aligned genres. Rod Serling, our UU brother, put it this way in the Twilight Zone episode entitled The Fugitive. Here's what he said. Science fiction is the improbable made possible. Fantasy is the impossible made probable. And that's on your word art that Sharon did for you. It should be in your seats, all Oprah-like. Again, I think you have some word art in your seat there. Okay, so since today I will be focusing on fantasy, let's look at that part of Rod Serling's definition again. The impossible made probable. In other words, taking that which could not actually happen and treating it as if it not only could, but often does. So commonly, this impossible is labeled as magic, as opposed to the improbable but within reach technology that defines science fiction. We may tend to think of fantasy as the past and science fiction as the future, but I think that can oversimplify how these two genres operate. So let's talk about that a little bit. Science fiction, I think, examines our relationship with the things that we build for our own curiosity or our own advantage. Again, you can cheer when you hear your favorites. Starships. Yes. The TARDIS. Yes. Dinosaur parks. Some Jurassic Park fans. Okay, artificial intelligence. Usually doesn't work out too well, but it's a science fiction trope. Science fiction asks essential questions like, what will happen if we walk down this path? How much humanity do we retain in the face of scientific discovery? And what might be lost? In fact, author Ian M. Banks called science fiction the most important genre there is, precisely because it focuses on that most important of human endeavors, change, both on a societal level and an individual level. But wait a minute here. I'm supposed to be focusing on fantasy. All right. Fantasy offers no illusions about human control. The heritage of fantasy literature is in the myths and legends and parables of old, and its stories tend to be grand tales of struggles to define humanity in the midst of the unknown and the uncontrollable. Magic plays out on a large chessboard in which we as people come to terms with the paradox of how A, insignificant, and B, vital, we all are at the same time. Magic can be a metaphor for many indefinable things: love, curiosity, creativity, power, transcendence, heritage, mortality. And I think these metaphors may have something to do with fantasy's staying power. They are what cultural theorist Raymond Williams called keywords. These are abstract ideas that are understood profoundly and understood individually. To meet each other with regard to these ideas, then, we must use metaphor as a way to communicate and, yes, to play together. So, in my opinion, both fantasy and science fiction contribute something that's essential to both literature and society. I wanted to focus on fantasy for this particular talk, given the ways it relates to our UU principles and social justice and social change through its relationship with the indefinable. When I ask my students in the class that Carlos talked about to write about why they're attracted to fantasy, they usually say something about characters and worlds and the books they love being more real to them than real life. I hear the word escapism a lot. And I don't want to discount the importance of playfulness and imagination that these stories provide. But as my sermon title, which is still up there, hints, I want to suggest that fantasy can actually help us find our place in, redefine, challenge, and disrupt the here and now, the real world. In much the same way as parables in sacred texts, which are very close to where fantasy began as literature, these stories allow intellectual, emotional, and even spiritual insight. And they do it using a metaphorical distance that may cross audience boundaries like nationality, age, gender, sexuality. Now, I want to pause here and problematize what I just said by acknowledging that there was a formative period of white heterosexual male pulp fantasy in which women were highly sexualized. And there's an argument to be made that fantasy is still in many ways defined by that white white male heterosexual wish fulfillment period. Still, while recognizing some of those problematic roots, I do want to examine fantasy's potential for initiating social justice and social change. The fact that there are so many UUs who resonate with these stories, I think, says something. So, I will look at fantasy along three different trajectories, which I will call signposts. This is in homage to the helpful lamppost in Narnia's Western Wastes, as well as the scarecrows this way, that way, in the MGM film version of The Wizard of Oz. So, these signposts, I want to suggest, are ways in which rather than escaping from the world through reading and thinking through fantasy, we can process our own reality and we can find our place in it. So this work is akin to what theater practitioner Augusto Boal called rehearsal for the revolution. Now for Boal, this was achieved by replaying scenes on stage until those scenes lead an audience to self-knowledge and to social action. But perhaps we can do the same work in the stage space of our reading minds, or on film, or through fan fiction, or through cosplay, which is dressing as a popular character. Okay, you may be smiling here, liberatory cosplay, what are you talking about? However, I have a colleague who has written at length about how Comic-Con attendees become in some fashion the characters that they costume themselves as, and how they use their brains, hearts, and courage to disrupt the familiar and create change. Okay, but back to the structure. I was going to tell you about the three signposts, so let me do that. Here they are, for those of you playing along in the Muggle world. The first one, identity and belonging. The second one, the world around us. And the third one, leadership and control. So if you're still with me, let's set down the road in our exploration. Signpost one, identity and belonging. So let's begin with what fantasy might teach us about who we are and how we understand ourselves in relation to others. As Madeline L'Engle put it, how do these stories help us to be named and loved? From the very beginning, identity formation has been a concern of fantasy. Early heroes rose from humble beginnings to wield magical weapons or pursue quests. The idea that greatness may come from less than noble birth or unknown noble birth, my Game of Thrones fans know who I'm talking about with unknown noble birth, R plus L equals J, okay, in Game of Thrones. All right. So these ideas had and still have a great pull on those of us who appreciate a little magic being brought into our everyday lives, a little help finding our own inherent value. So, is it wish fulfillment to imagine ourselves as witches or wizards or vampire slayers or airbenders? Well, of course it is wish fulfillment. But, As Ursula Le Guin wrote in today's reading, fantasy may not be factual, but it is true. We may not pull Excalibur out of a stone. We may not have an owl who delivers acceptance letters to us, but we are ordinary people who are capable of taking extraordinary action. As Galadriel tells the hobbits in the film version of Lord of the Rings, even the smallest person can change the course of the future. Now hold on, Drew, you may be thinking. There may be a few hobbits or scrappy farm boys, but much of fantasy deals with royalty or tradition. Talk about dragging society back to pre-Enlightenment ideals. It's all about privileged characters. And to you, I say, okay, fair point. And also, I do want to point out that there are many non-privileged characters in fantasy who are treated as outcasts. Hermione Granger, for example, is derided as a mudblood because of her non-magical parentage. She's taunted, she's disregarded, and in Deathly Hallows, she is chillingly tortured. Nevertheless, she persists. Hermione, yes, you can clap for Hermione. Absolutely. Hermione allows us to rehearse for bullying or for exclusion in our own lives. She reminds us to be proud of our interests and proud of our abilities. She is the ethical core of the Harry Potter series. More ethical, I would argue, than even the powerful and privileged Albus Dumbledore. I imagine that Hermione would be an excellent role model for young women interested in STEM or in sports or in the military, giving them ideas of how to handle a world that's historically cold or even hostile toward women's presence. The closely aligned idea of difference is also often highlighted in fantasy literature. Think of the Game of Thrones episode titled Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things, and those characters who fall outside the norms of Westeros society. John, again, you can cheer for your favorites. Jon Snow, Tyrion Lannister, Bran Stark. Not so much for Bran. Okay, Arya Stark. There we go. These characters attempt to deconstruct and reform Westeros from the outside, or the Fellowship of the Ring and its coalition of individuals with differing backgrounds that make for a strong and cohesive group. Fantasy suggests that we can all help each other toward various kinds of growth, including spiritual growth. We simply need to respect what everyone brings to the common quest. Variation on this theme, the prophecy, found in much fantasy literature. In Harry Potter, Professor Trelawney states that neither Harry nor Voldemort can live while the other survives, setting in motion the long arc of the series. Prophecies like these harken back to the fate versus free will debate that fascinated the people of early Mediterranean cultures. They ask us through metaphor to consider ourselves as writers of our own stories versus pawns with little agency of our own, buffeted by outside forces like tradition and social structures. In the real world, of course, we are bound by markers, nationality, income, cultural capital, and many more, which come with expectations. Call them prophecies, if you like. We need each other to push back against these prophecies. We need co-authors in order to write the stories that we want to write for ourselves. All right, we have arrived at signpost 2, the world around us. If you were to picture your favorite fantasy world, what would you observe? Would you see a castle? Would you see a forest or an ocean? A magical creature? Would the land be peaceful or would it be in conflict? This duality is at the core of many fantasy worlds. Just as a light is both particle and wave, these spaces are both idols and wastelands. The great post-war British writers C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien captured this in their depictions of Narnia and of Middle-earth. Narnia, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is famously a desolate place where it is always winter, but never... Thank you. Until love returns in the person of Aslan the Lion. In Tolkien, the dwarves dig too deep into the beautiful mountain of Minas Tirith and wake an ancient evil in the form of the Balrog. Saruman tears down the forests of his domain until the living land moves against him. So these stories highlight one of the great questions of the 20th and 21st centuries. What are our responsibilities to the world around us? How much control do we have, and frankly, should we have, over land which existed long before us and will also outlive us? Writer-director Hayao Miyazaki in My Neighbor Totoro and other Studio Ghibli films points toward our interdependence with nature and the thin line that separates paradise and desolation. Miyazaki also suggests that children are closer to magic and nature than adults are, and adults need to remember the things that they learned about the world very early in life. Another important fantasy world trope can be found in Dorothy Gale's realization that there's no place like home. In this phrase, which was borrowed from an old 1880s tune popular during the Civil War, the MGM screenwriters adapted Dorothy's line from Baum's novel. And the line in the novel was, "It's so good to be home again." Regardless of the change or the actual words, the sentiment is the same. Home is central. Home is magical. Safety is also bound up in the idea of home. Vampires can't enter a home uninvited. Rapunzel is told that she is safe as long as she stays in the tower in which her false mother has placed her. In a real-world context, these ideas of home and safety have been challenged recently with things like zero-tolerance policies, school shootings, evictions, and natural disasters, all of which sever families. There are serious questions here. Where can young people find safety? Is home a place, or is it a group of people? Fantasy literature may help readers rehearse these questions and prepare to forge new homes or to help others with the process if safety is compromised. As J.K. Rowling noted, if Harry Potter taught us anything, it's that no one should live in a closet. Signpost number 3, leadership and control. So philosophers through much of history have argued that leadership is central to a working society. Without it, we humans would lack a sense of cohesion, a sense of justice, and a vision for the future. As you use, we seek a democratic process. We seek a community that includes equity for everyone. Fantasy literature has asked the question, who is fit to lead? And what does that leader owe to the people that he or she governs? In the Song of Ice and Fire or Game of Thrones series, this is the central concern. There are multiple claimants to the throne, and each has a distinct vision for the land of Westeros. As readers, we get to compare these visions, and we get to think through our own relationship with leadership and our values compared to those of our leaders. We get to ask the question, would we want someone like Cersei Lannister leading us? Would we want someone like Daenerys Targaryen? Would we want someone like Jon Snow? And who in the real world exemplifies those characters' values? One of the most frightening autocrats in fantasy literature, I would argue, is Dolores Umbridge, who enters the Harry Potter narrative in The Order of the Phoenix, book number 5. Umbridge is a malevolent official. She's guided by a set of values that she wholeheartedly believes will make the wizarding world great.
Again.
And Umbridge is endowed with more and more power as her support for Lord Voldemort increases. The scene in which Harry is forced to write, "I must not tell lies," on parchment, as the words simultaneously are cut into his skin, literally inscribing him with Umbridge's authority, is a chilling, chilling scene. But it is all too true, despite not being factual. What's been inscribed by all of us, by leaders who desire unquestioned obedience over critical thought? How can we respond when these people and these institutions attempt to exert tyrannical control? when sometimes it seems that we have as little say in our own democracy as the characters in fantasy's feudal societies. Well, author Neil Gaiman writes, "Fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. On a local level, we can call power to account through community action, or we can become ethical leaders ourselves as teachers or managers or even parents. We can make sure that all voices in a classroom have presence. We can comfort those who are marginalized. We can ensure that those who work for us are given fair treatment. We can be the good leaders that we see in these books. Dragons can be beaten. History can be redirected. It takes time. It takes carefully nurtured coalitions. But it is possible." Conclusion. All right, here's the big finish. For the big finish, I'd like to return to Boal's theory of rehearsal for the revolution, or as his mentor, the educational and linguistic theorist Paulo Freire expressed it, thinking, acting, and reflecting. So Boal, as I mentioned, does this in the stage space. But how can we, in our own lives, make the leap from metaphor to reality? After all, as Ernest Cline writes in Ready Player One, and he's playing here on an old Groucho Marx joke, "As terrifying and painful as reality can be, it's also the only place that you can get a decent meal." Yeah, I like that one too. In today's reading, J.D. Newman suggests that in order to create something, we have to be able to imagine it first. And I think that that imagination is the key. So let's go back to all those students that I mentioned who signed up for my fantasy and sci-fi course because they wanted somewhere to belong. Over our semester together, I watch them as they take their passion and make it into something uniquely theirs and something that has impact in the world around them. Because vision does indeed become reality. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti keeps Harry Potter wands in his office at City Hall. President John F. Kennedy modeled his cabinet on the Court of Camelot. I hope that kids no longer need to feel marginalized because of the things that bring them joy. It seems like every day there are more and more people getting over their fear of dragons. So I invite all of you to think about your own imagined ideal societies. What's on the other side of your wardrobe? And how can you bring that, the best of it, to this world? So I'll leave you with one of my favorite Harry Potter quotes. As Harry trains Dumbledore's army, he says, "Every great wizard in history has started out as no more than we are now, students. If they can do it, why not us?" We're all students our entire lives, and I think that all of us are capable of greatness. Fantasy is the impossible made probable. So I encourage all of you to find your own magic, because all of us have it. And I invite you to use that magic to change for the better this beautiful and troubled world that's all around us. Thank you very much.